your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's masks on and away we go. Welcome to Flat Chat, where we're flushing 2020 down the toilet as the January 2021 issue of GP Racing magazine hits the shelves. Hopefully this won't turn out to be a year which, like a wedding cake, ends in tears. Joining me to chew over the latest GP racing before the tumbleweed clears, and before indeed he jets off to sunnier climes, is Mark Gallagher.
Hello, nice to be with you. Gosh, yes, I will be in sunnier climes next time round, won't I?
You will. Next time we speak, we'll be saying g'day, Cobber, and yeah. People will be jamming the switchboards to complain about national stereotyping. provided you can survive 2 weeks in a hotel without dismantling the Corby trouser press.
Well, I'm actually hoping that the next podcast, I will actually be in said hotel. I'll be in quarantine in Australia. Good chance that will be the case. But certainly, this will be a much-needed break. Please send chocolate and other food parcels to wherever I am.
I hope room service is kind. And in my other window on my screen, kids freshly packed off to nursery, eyelids propped up on matchsticks. Ben Anderson can join us without toddlers bouncing off the walls in the background.
Yes, indeed. Listen to that in the background. Ah, blissful silence. I can almost hear the bird song outside in the garden.
And speaking of blissful silence, I have to warn and apologise to listeners in advance if there are noises off, because so a bunch of tree surgeons pulled up out back of Codling Manor and have started disassembling various bits of foliage relating to the former adult education centre, which property developers have got their hands on. So I think it hoofed it down with rain about 20 minutes ago, so they stopped, but who knows when they start again.
And I can't hear any chainsaws, Codders.
Yeah, the cats are furious, but Mrs. Codling is worried that this may be the last time we see the tree that looks like Alice Cooper, as she calls it. Basically, after dark, this tree looks exactly like Alice Cooper.
Are you sure it's the tree?
Maybe she's brushed her hair forward. Anyhow, enough about foliage matters. On to GP racing, and the editorial crystal ball has been a success. This month our cover star is George Russell, and a remarkable series of events ensued in the weeks after we made the decision to focus on him and stick him on the cover. No sooner had Luke Smith's elegantly crafted cover feature landed in the inbox than George found himself shoehorned into the cockpit of Lewis Hamilton's Mercedes. The question is, will he ever sit there again? Did he do enough to impress? I know, Mark, you've picked up a lot of Twitter followers in the George Russell fan community.
I have indeed. I seem to have a lot of, I think predominantly women, who have decided to start following me because I said some positive things about George Russell. But then why wouldn't you say positive things about George Russell after the job that he did in Sakhir? And also, quite honestly, why were we surprised that he did a great job for Mercedes-Benz? I think there is a little bit of a notion, isn't there, that you know, getting into a top car like the Mercedes is going to somehow be a massive challenge. The reality is George is made for that drive. He's got tons of experience now driving for the Williams car. He even knows the power unit's characteristics. He's young, he's talented, he's a multiple champion in junior formula. And so actually the mystery was why anyone was surprised he did a cracking job.
Well, he wasn't quite made for the drive because he couldn't quite fit in the car, could he?
Well, this is true. He's actually not.
Boots that were too small and basically have his shoulders chopped off to get into Lewis's seat.
Yeah.
There you go, details.
I mean, am I picking nits?
Yeah, you are. I mean, I have to say, it is good that he can fit in a Formula One car, because not that many years ago, he would have been told by pretty well everyone to forget about it. He's just not going to make it. But he's 6'2", I believe, isn't that right?
He's pretty tall. Yeah. And I remember Alex Wirtz was told by Flavio Briatore he should have an operation in which his is it the femur, the what bits that the leggy, the bony bits below the knee? He should basically have those shortened. Was Flavio's take?
Yeah, that was useful. That was a useful piece of contribution to the management.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Of a driver from Flavio. I hope Alex.
Here's your winter training program.
Yeah,
Alex.
Exactly. I mean, Alex. I hope Alex told Flavio to go and have an operation to have his moral compass reset as to the way in which
impossible.
Yeah, exactly. Gosh. Horrific, but yeah. Anyway, you know, you're absolutely right, Ben. Apart from the physical attributes, I mean, he was always going to do a cracking job, and he really did. He delivered perfectly. And yes, as a result, I find myself with another 100 George Russell fans following me on Twitter.
They say hopefully they'll all buy the magazine as well and keep us in business. This is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I think actually putting the front cover on Twitter will probably increase, you know, reach into the George Russell market substantially. So yeah, I'll make sure I do that.
The cover is a bone of contention because, of course, you know, we have these meetings, we circulate the putative contents list, and that, you know, when we all go on Teams, and there's either silence from our art editor, or there's the telltale noise of Philip Schofield and This Morning in the background if he's doing daycare for his elderly mother. But the ominous noise either of silence or of that bloke from Money Saving Expert dispensing financial tips means there's something wrong. And in this case, he floated the very, very real issue we had, which was we had no pictures of George Russell we could put on the cover. But then we realised we did have some left over from a previous shoot in which he was thankfully wearing his civvies. So he was in neither Mercedes nor Williams garb for the cover image. So once again, you know, our bacon was saved. But I'm starting to think that in this COVID era, we are going to start running out of cover pictures soon. We're going to have to have people in masks.
Well, the cupboard is bare.
I think the cover photograph is spectacular. He like all racing drivers, he has a very thick neck, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, yes, it's all that G-force that goes through it.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, yeah, nice cover. So yes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was a good one to do. It's nice to put a less heralded driver on the cover from time to time, and I suppose before. We're kind of fortunate that Sakhir played out the way it did, because before that race, it's always a slight punt to be putting a driver on the cover who hasn't scored a point in Formula One, is racing for a team that's at the back of the grid. You know, the best he can do on a given weekend is make Q2 and fight for about 14th or 15th place. And people will look at you and say, well, you know, what are you doing? You know, he's a nobody in Formula One terms. And then, of course, the whole point of the feature is to say, well, you know, here is a guy who you may not have seen too much of, who's actually doing a stunning job in a pretty slow car, as acknowledged by many of the, you know, famous voices quoted in the feature, among them Fernando Alonso, who himself did a similar job for Minardi at the start of his career, and look what he went on to achieve. And of course, then Lewis Hamilton goes and gets COVID, can't race. George gets his chance in the best car on the grid, and he proves our punt correct, that he's a star of the future and a driver to watch. You know, he's very likely to be the next world champion for Mercedes after Lewis stops. And of course, even though Toto Wolff spent the whole weekend saying George being in the car doesn't apply extra pressure to Valtteri Bottas and isn't a shootout for 2022, and nor does it help or affect negotiations with Lewis over his new contract, which is yet to be signed. Of course, it does both of those things very neatly, because Mercedes now have been able to prove to themselves that George is a guy that is capable of slotting straight into a top car and running at the front and winning a race. And also they now know how he stacks up directly against Bottas. They've got a proper data set to go on. They don't need to have potentially this interim season where what can George do in a better car than the Williams? Do we need to try and shoehorn him into a more competitive midfield team first? No, they can say we've got somebody ready, waiting, knocking at the door who can put pressure on our current lineup. So they can't afford either of them to get too comfortable over the next 12 months.
I think not
clever, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think not only do Mercedes now have all of that information and data and knowledge and awareness of George's capabilities, but Lewis and Valtteri also have that knowledge, and that affects both of them, because I'm sure in Valtteri's case, with a one-year deal for 2021, he now realises, if he didn't realise before, that he has a major threat to his drive on the horizon, and that George could step in and do a cracking job. And, you know, as per the, you know, the points, some of the points that are made in the feature, one of the things that's been very successful about the current Mercedes lineup is that Valtteri and Lewis don't bounce off each other, literally and figuratively, the way that Nico Rosberg and Lewis did. And Toto Wolff and James Allison and the leadership team there really appreciate the fact that they've got a good, quick pairing with a pretty discernible number one, number two structure, and they don't really want to upset that. I have to say, I think that George is such an intelligent guy that if he was given that opportunity in 2022 to replace Valtteri, I mean, I don't think he'd be going in there with the intention of butting heads with Lewis, but he would just let his driving do the talking, and it would be a pretty formidable combination, Lewis and George. And as I say, Valtteri will know this only too well, and once again he'll have to hit that reset button. I suspect his reset button's pretty well worn by now, but
is this Valtteri 3.5?
Yeah,
4.0,
I think it's
6.2.
I think it's 6.2, still with a few big bugs to get rid of, particularly in terms of starts and keeping the car straight going through the first couple of corners. He seems to have had a few issues, but anyway, it's just been a beautiful opportunity for George. And as you say, Ben, Mercedes now have had so many questions answered. It's not really going to be a huge decision when it comes to it.
Could be some big pressure on Lewis as well, I feel, because potentially should Mercedes slot Russell in alongside Lewis in the future and decide to replace Bottas. I mean, Toto's already said, you know, that would be a wild ride, so he'd have to probably roll his sleeves up and anticipate at some point a return to the darker days of tension between teammates, because, you know, George Russell isn't there to make up the numbers.
No.
Team bosses who've worked with him in the past say he's a tough character, obviously a good guy, but he knows how to push the team. He's demanding, and I have a feeling that, you know, given what we know about how good he is and how highly rated he is by his peers within Formula One, there's the potential for a similar dynamic that we've seen at Ferrari in the last couple of years. You know, established world champion in Vettel, I mean, I'd have to say Lewis is obviously, well, seems clear now, is a better driver than Vettel, but Leclerc went into that team expected to be the understudy, and within one race was already completely upsetting the order of things. And I feel like George Russell is potentially on that similar kind of level. So once he goes in there, it's going to be very difficult for Mercedes to maintain a similar dynamic to the one they have now. I think Russell will be straight in there putting pressure on Lewis.
Absolutely, no question.
And you're going to have to be managing that situation. It's whether Lewis can respond in a way that, you know, Vettel ultimately couldn't against Leclerc. I mean, that said, Vettel did say, I think, at his final race for Ferrari, that Leclerc was the best driver he came across in Formula One in his 15 years. So yeah, that tells you how good he is. But it does seem potentially that Russell is, you know, is in that bracket potentially. So it could be pretty exciting if Mercedes do take the plunge.
And of course, by the start of the 2022 season, when the new regulations come in, if George did join the team, Lewis would be 37 years of age by that age. Not to say 37 is too old. I mean, he's
10 years ahead of him easily. They're bionic men until their 60s, aren't they? The way things are going, I mean, Raikkonen will still be in F1.
I mean, Lewis won't even be old enough to take part in the young drivers' test in Abu Dhabi. I mean, you have to be.
Oh no, he will. You have to be dispensation.
You have to be 39 to do that. Oh, sorry, and drive for a French team. That's the other thing. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot that. Yeah.
Well, it's all about perception, though, isn't it? And you know, age. When you're around that age bracket, you sort of feel fine. It's younger people who think you're cracking on a little bit. I remember vividly, because it was so funny, being at a London Irish rugby match when Mike Catt played his last game before retirement, and there was on the row behind us there was a kid who knew everything about rugby and was telling his mate everything, and when Mike Catt came on at half time or thereabouts for his last bit, the kid goes, "Now this guy, he's so old, he's like your granddad, he's 38
Okay, so try adding 20 years to that and you discover that you develop super powers such as invisibility. As soon as you hit over, as soon as you go over 50, you're just invisible. So I think that's probably why my remaining media career is limited to podcasting as opposed to being in front of a camera. I keep saying that DC is... I don't know if he listens to this podcast, but DC's about to turn 50 next.
It's going to be like Logan's Run. He'll get sucked up into some giant sort of butcher's fly zapper in the sky.
He'll become a ghost.
I mean, there can't be that many people on Channel 4 who are that age. He's kind of going to be entering the danger zone.
They'll be whistling him up a Zimmer frame for his birthday.
but you make an important point, Codders, because you know there's always this tension between the young guys coming up and Formula One should give more of them a chance. And of course, George Russell's performance for Mercedes suggests there's a lot of truth in that, and that F1 teams should be braver. And we're seeing some of the bigger teams, Ferrari particularly, now embrace that more and say, yes, actually, we're going to back the younger drivers, we're going to invest in junior talent, bring it through, and then actually back it to perform at the highest level, not just spend millions and millions and millions hiring, guys with reputations and perhaps inflated reputations. But at the same time, there's still jobs going for the likes of Kimi Raikkonen and Fernando Alonso. So sometimes experience does win through, and, someone like Alonso, Renault obviously are convinced that he can perform at the highest level better than Daniel Ricciardo potentially, and Kimi, we think his career is going to stop, and it just keeps on rolling. Yeah. Of course, he was the highest placed Ferrari engine driver in Abu Dhabi, so he's still doing something right.
Yeah, he'll still be having a Formula One career. When they have to wheel him in a bath chair, he'll be still driving.
Sponsored by Stenalift.
I can't imagine he's got a big career as a TV pundit for Formula One when he finishes, unless Sky Sports...
He said, hasn't he? He said that he won't come back for that sort of thing. He'd only come back if, say his kids were interested and either wanted to see it or they wanted to go racing or ended up racing in it. But yeah, he's explicitly said he's not interested in the TV stuff. Surprise, surprise.
Unless you turn the whole thing sort of 180 degrees and Sky Sports just cut to him for a one-word summary of each race. He has to summarize it in one word, and that's his contribution.
They wouldn't be able to broadcast that word a lot of the time, I think. It'd just be a bleep, wouldn't it?
what they could do, if they were going to be funny and clever about it, they could have basically a hot tub with a fridge full of beer, and Kimmy's job every weekend is just to sit in the hot tub, drink beer, and occasionally they'll cut to him and say,
with Sergei Sorokin and Johnny Herbert or alone.
Oh dear Lord, dear me.
Yeah.
that was our staple diet on the big screen over last winter, the other winter, wasn't it? Sergei Sorokin and Johnny Herbert in a hot tub. Did you not see that, Mark?
No, I didn't. I thought this podcast had a family rating.
It's compelling. It's supposedly compelling viewing on Sky F1, given the number of times it was on constant rotation. Now, of course, if you go into our office, on that screen you'll find ITV3 plus one and a diet of classic Emmerdale and Heartbeat. For the three people who are there.
And, so more rehashing.
Yeah, more rehashing. They're somewhere in the 90s at the moment. When I last popped in the office, the registration plates on the cars suggested mid-90s, and our HR guy said, yeah, it's a few weeks since they had the aeroplane disaster where half the cast got wiped out. So that's where we are in classic Emmerdale. The axe has swung on the regular cast as new producer comes in. But once again, we've deviated from the subject at hand.
I wonder whose fault that is.
It's my fault. Like it always is. Shall we revert back, as one of our former colleagues would say, to discussing the contents of the latest GP racing.
Marvellous idea.
We've done the crystal ball thing. We also take more than a cursory glance in the rearview mirror this month, because Mark has done a pithily entitled feature called How Not to Do F1, and it's the story of how Toyota spent a fortune starting a Formula One team and came away sort of 8 or 9 years later with very little. Common sense in shorter supply than Zimmer frames in the Abu Dhabi Young Driver Test. Mark, I sensed while reading this that you gained some enjoyment in doing this brutal takedown and speaking to all the people involved.
Yeah, I really did enjoy it, because I think there's a lot to be learned from... There's more to be learned from failure, I think, in Formula One than from success, because when we look at success, of course, you see all the great teamwork and the technical innovations that the teams bring that to the table when they win a world championship. When you see a giant car manufacturer of Toyota's ilk and Honda coming to
Freudian slip.
Yeah, well, that's right. Japanese Freudian slip. When you see them come in and fail as they did in the 2000s, and BMW as well, of course, and Jaguar. You know, the car industry generally really seemed to struggle with how to do Formula One, and I think because I joined Jaguar at the time when Tony Purnell, you know, told me, he said the team is up for sale, we need to find a new owner, and we started the process of trying to figure out who would take Jaguar on to its next phase. I got such an insight in a few months into the way Jaguar operated as a team and why it wasn't successful. And there were so many aspects to it which were a shock to the system. But Toyota was of another magnitude again. And you know, Ben, you will have I know you had a read at the feature when I submitted it. That one statistic from Mike Gascoigne, former technical director there, that the technical budget in one season was £343 million. And you think about the numbers that are bandied around Formula One at the moment, and you consider that this is, you know, over a decade and a half ago, they were, and that was just a technical budget. I mean, the marketing budget would have been on top, and then executive salaries and all the rest of it. So this was a team spending, you know, probably £450 million a year on Formula One. They had everything on paper going for them. And, I mean, they actually became the world's largest car manufacturer during the course of that whole sojourn in Formula One. And they just never cracked it. Didn't win a single race. Best season they had was actually with Mike Gascoigne as technical director. And they then, you know, summarily sacked him. And I did enjoy writing it, only from the perspective of just re-looking at some of the reasons why Toyota never quite understood what was required in order to do Formula One properly. And it was fun to do it. And of course, great fun talking to some of the people who were there, particularly Mike Gascoigne and Alan McNish, who were very open about their experience there. They certainly weren't, both of them said exactly the same thing about the people who were at Toyota in terms of the workforce, the mechanics, the engineering staff, how good they were. So there wasn't a lack of money. There wasn't a lack of talent. The facilities were world class. So this had to do with leadership structure, the way in which the team was focused, all the things that we know that Toto Wolff is particularly good at doing at Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah, it's those final bits, isn't it? Those final details that usually make the difference between a proper success and a failure. And of course, no, we described it as how not to do F1 and a failure, and it was in terms of the ambition. But of course, Toyota were reasonably competitive for a long time in Formula 1 and got some good results. But you feel like when you hear those sorts of numbers that they squandered so much of the resource. And I felt like also, I don't know how you feel about this, Mark, but there's perhaps something in this story that gives us an insight into what's happened more recently with Honda as well, another Japanese manufacturer coming into F1. Mm. Okay, not now starting its whole own team from scratch, but you know, McLaren were endlessly talking about, you know, resource and how much technical know-how and great facilities and money no object there was at Honda in terms of meeting the challenge of this engine formula. Mm. And yet they just couldn't do it. And then when they finally get close, they disappear.
Yeah. There's a disconnect in the way that the leadership in Honda have done Formula One in this era, the one that we're looking at now, and also the previous iteration of Honda's involvement in Formula One. The fact that they kind of get in and thrash around in an uncompetitive way for quite a long period of time, and then they begin to accumulate the understanding of what it takes. It's like they've gone back up the learning curve again. They finally have gotten to the point where they've learned from their past mistakes. And it was very much like that with Honda in the 2000s. They got to 2008 and then they pulled the plug. And as we all know, the same team won the world championship the following year, albeit with the Mercedes engine thrown in the back of the Braun. And I often wonder, you know, I would love to have been a fly on the wall of the Honda board level meetings in 2009 when they saw their team less than 12 months later win the Formula One World Championship. I mean, if that doesn't cause you to pause and rethink what were we doing wrong? And then they've come back in this time, and they've kind of done the same thing again. They came in, they've thrashed around with McLaren. They came in prematurely. Their technology was out of date. They didn't realise the technology was out of date. They started playing catch-up. They effectively used McLaren as a test programme. And now with Red Bull and with AlphaTauri, you know, they've got it right. They've won with both those teams. And have now decided to go out again. And it's just such a colossal waste of money and time. It can't be said to be in any way, shape or form good for business. And I think that's kind of knee-jerk reaction that happens. Clearly, COVID, I'm sure, has had an effect, because I think COVID is in the background of so many seismic changes that are taking place in industry at the moment, because as everyone looks towards post-COVID, everyone seems to be also looking forward to a greener world, a kinder world post-COVID, you know, because everyone now says, well, okay, COVID was an immediate crisis. Vaccine has been developed in 10 months instead of 10 years. If we applied the same kind of approach to climate change and environmental sustainability, you know, could we accelerate the solutions for that? So you can kind of understand Honda's thinking. The thing that I find really bizarre is that they Honda don't see an opportunity to play a role in helping frame Formula One for that kinder, environmentally friendly technology that needs to be developed. I mean, if ever there was an opportunity for Honda to play a central role, not just in Formula One, but in helping to create the technologies that would benefit society, this could have been the moment. But clearly they have felt it isn't, you know, back at headquarters. And again, with the Toyota piece, what's very striking is the is the disconnect between the racers who knew fundamentally how to do Formula One and the leadership team who really didn't, who knew the Toyota way, literally the Toyota way of doing things, and the way in which Formula One was framed against internal benchmarking within Toyota. And as Mike Gascoigne very eloquently put, you know, the writing reports to prove your value to your bosses in Japan is of no value. The only report that matters is the results that are posted on a Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. You're first or you're last, or you're second or you're fifth or whatever. That's the report that matters. And again, I very much saw that at Jaguar, is that it's really interesting how these well-funded, you know, Jaguar is quite well-funded, certainly not as well-funded as Toyota, but nevertheless, compared to privately owned teams, these well-funded car manufacturer teams can fall into a trap of somehow accepting that, well, you know, this year finishing fourth in the championship is the best that we can do, so that becomes our target. I don't think Toto Wolff has ever gone to sleep at night thinking, yeah, fourth would be a great result. you know, let's, you know, we're I mean, Toto Wolff's interest in a year of transition probably couldn't be. I mean, who wants to be in transition? There are teams in Formula One that have been in, they're in a permanent transition. They're in transition from mediocrity to mediocrity. So at what point do we see, you know, the results triggered that actually mean that you're a competitor as opposed to a participant in Formula One? And so I think I'm probably passionate about this as well, because I spent, you know, nearly a decade and a half at Jordan, and as a small independent team which did win a few Grand Prix and you know, was a thorn in the side to the big teams, we would have loved to have had a budget approaching that level, because I think we would have done well with it. The really interesting thing about that feature as well, Ben, is that whenever you tasked me with doing that one, I mean, I could have written a book about the stories that came out during it. There was one story that I didn't even manage to get in, and it was actually about a call that I had from Toyota when I set up Stadis Grand Prix to do the A1GP Championship, and I got a call from someone at Toyota who I won't name to save them their blushes, to say, we just heard that you've bought tire warmers for the A1GP car. And I said, yeah, we've just ordered, you know, four sets of tire warmers or whatever. And he said, well, we have 100 unused sets. They're brand new. And we've got 100 sets of brand new. They're in a warehouse. You can just have them. And I said, so why have you got 100 sets of brand new tire warmers that you don't need? He said, oh, they were branded incorrectly. Now, that just kind of
wandering.
Yeah, that just cuts. Wandering. That really cuts to the chase of where the whole thing goes wrong. I mean, I can tell you, if you work for Eddie Jordan and you wrongly branded the tire warmers, I mean, yes, he would have given you a bollocking. But if you had said, oh, shall we just buy 100 new ones? He would have said, no, buy a sticker and put it over the wrong branding. I don't care what you'd, you know, it just wouldn't have been. He would have not wanted to waste the money. And I think that's that kind of mentality is where it all starts to go wrong. It's just there's actually too much money available, and it becomes, I think, the hunger, and that there's nothing like having a slightly having a mentality of scarcity and urgency. So urgency to get the job done, and a scarcity that, you know, we're not here to waste resources. We're here to make every dollar, every pound, every euro count in our quest for success. And then for everyone in the team to know that we're actually here to win. And I think that, so that, you know, all of those things really combined, and it was a very interesting feature to have to put together.
It's interesting you mentioned Toto, because he is highly unusual in that he has that understanding of the corporate world, doesn't he? He can swim in those waters, but he's also a racing man in the way that, bless him, John Howard wasn't. He was a company man who dabbled his toes in the waters of motor racing at Toyota. And, you know, when you speak of a disconnect, there was that huge gulf between the people in the boardroom who sign off a hugely expensive Formula One program and perhaps are thinking, and maybe they've been sold the idea that if they spend that money, they'll see a return on that investment very quickly. Whereas, as we all know, you know, Formula One is an unpredictable game. There's no guarantee that that you will succeed straight away. And Toyota and Honda laboured for a very long time before getting anywhere near the front of the grid in the latest iteration. As you mentioned, Toyota had finally got a decent car and were putting it on pole regularly when the plug was pulled.
Yeah, it was all unfortunately too little too late.
I was disappointed that you didn't mention, if Mike mentioned it, his story of how he used to keep a remote control tank under the desk to fire at
He told me the whole story, but the problem is that was 500 words that I couldn't possibly fit into the piece. And actually I asked him about it, and I sort of in my shorthand I wrote down the story that he told me. It was a model Challenger Mark II tank that he had under his desk. Yeah, and he said the thing he was happiest about was that it not only was a remote control and could move around with a turret and everything, but it fired actual bullets. And he said I used to really enjoy shooting people in the office. And he said my team thought it was hilarious, but he said I'm not sure my Japanese bosses appreciated being shot at by a Challenger Mark II tank every time they came in the office. So yeah, that was definitely one for another one for the memoirs later on.
Yeah, the extended remix.
Yeah, yeah.
Squandering the budget.
Yeah.
I think that's where going back to Toto, that's where he's been particularly clever, because the theme that comes out of your story about Toyota and our discussions about Honda and Jaguar and whatnot, other manufacturer teams, is this idea that, you know, the check gets signed off by the corporate bigwigs and it comes with conditions attached, interference, perhaps misguided values or a certain corporate philosophy that doesn't mesh at all with Formula One. It might be the Toyota way. It might be Honda's desire to use it as a training ground for their engineers and learn how to develop their own technology and fix their mistakes. And once they've achieved that, they don't really mind about the rest of it. They're not in it to win. They're not really racers. They're there for other means. Whereas Toto's been able to perhaps bridge that gap quite well. He runs Mercedes F1 team like a race team. He's got the commercial head. He's tried to make it, as you've written before for us, Mark, more independent of the manufacturer as well. So it has to wash its own face as much as possible. He has to find independent partners. And it manages to keep Mercedes a little bit at arm's length on the corporate side. Obviously, he still has to keep them happy. But he's not quite, it doesn't seem like he's quite so dependent on them, their money and their philosophies as perhaps other manufacturer teams have been in the past.
Well, I think the fact that Toto and Niki Lauda negotiated to own a sizable minority of the team automatically gave Mercedes-Benz F1 independence from head office, which Toyota F1 didn't have. Actually, Toyota F1 was not only a fully owned subsidiary of the parent company, but it actually physically, geographically sat at the European hub of Toyota in Cologne. So, you know, from every perspective, it was absolutely embedded within the overall organization. I think, you know, when the history of Mercedes and Formula One comes to be written, there will be, I'm sure, a lot of reflection on the fact that although Norbert Hogg did a great job as a, you know, important partner to McLaren and the success that they achieved winning the world championship with, you know, the likes of Mika Hakkinen and, of course, Kimi Raikkonen, but actually, Mercedes unlocked its true potential by having its own team. But the difference was, by that point, Mercedes, after 15 years effectively of being an engine supplier, Mercedes-Benz had learned that if you're going to do a Formula One team as a car manufacturer, it needs to be an entrepreneurially led team. And in that respect, and we were joking a little bit earlier on about Flavio Briatore, I mean, but one of the things that Flavio was great at doing was that he convinced the Benetton, well, he was put in by the Benetton family, and then with Benetton, Renault, and then Renault. Flavio understood how to run a Formula One team as a business in its own right, distinct from whoever the parent was, be it Benetton, be it Renault, and he did a very good job with that. I think actually Mercedes-Benz have taken that model and run with it very successfully, and it is a lesson, you know, for everyone else. And again, you know, and again, this is why I think for all of us who find the backstory to Formula One so fascinating, this is another reason why the trials and tribulations of Ferrari is so difficult to understand, because here is a team that really ought to be the benchmark within the sport, and they've just had their worst season in 40 years, and yet they apparently again should have all the attributes of success. So this inability for some to get Formula One right is always worth taking a look at, because as I said earlier, you know, it's great lauding the success of a team like Mercedes-Benz, but how interesting is it to look at those who have on paper everything they need and just can't make it work?
Well, Toyota always used to, I won't say the word boast, because that wasn't part of the Toyota way, but the F1 team liked to spin it that they were basically doing the same thing as Ferrari and making the car and engine under one roof. And they didn't get very far with it, did they?
No. Well, the thing is, one thing to say you were being like Ferrari when Ferrari were winning 5 consecutive world championships with Michael Schumacher, which, and I tell a Schumacher story in the Toyota piece, which
yes,
which was about their
the London Bridge story,
which is about their signing the London Bridge story.
Yeah, it's like the Americans who thought they were buying Tower Bridge, and they'd actually bought London Bridge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't think we'll tell that story in the podcast. You need to go and buy the magazine and read about what happened when Toyota signed.
Went after Schumacher.
Went yeah. after Schumacher. Went after
We've a... hired Schumacher.
Schumacher. Yeah. Exactly.
Whoopsie. Let's turn our eyes back to the future now. Marty, it's your kids. And 2021, we are talking about the January 2021 issue of GP Race, and we are starting to turn our eyes towards the next Formula One season. And at the moment, the putative, if I may use that word for a second time in the same podcast, calendar has 23 races on it, and we'll be doing very well if we do that. But hey, we've just had 17 races, and it didn't look like any of them were going to happen. And what one of those sites will be Saudi Arabia, and that is the topic of your column this month, Mark. Because I mean, who knew that we had in our midst a former guest of the Nicky Campbell Show?
I have to say, before you go on, Mark, that this column is outstanding. And I would urge people who are on the fence about buying the magazine to buy it for this column, at least, because well, I think good. It's worth it. I think it's worth the admission price alone. It is a very good column.
Okay, well, thank you. I enjoyed writing it. It was actually the easiest column I've ever had to write, because with the announcement of a Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, the vitriol that was being poured on Formula One and social media, and indeed in mainstream media as well, talking about Formula
Virtue
One.
Virtue signalling, surely not.
Yeah, Formula One, Formula One selling its soul to Saudi Arabia, and oil money and all that good stuff, and quite rightly, many people pointing out that Saudi Arabia has, in Western terms, major human rights issues, and particularly their attitude and indeed their laws concerning homosexuality and the way in which diversity of the kind which we spend so much time talking about here in the West now is being so important to our countries and our organisations and society, is rejected in those terms in Saudi Arabia. And so there was a very, I felt very strongly that people were getting that wrong, because I think that actually only a very cursory look at where else we go racing in Formula One, be it, Russia or Azerbaijan or China or even for some people, the United States. I mean, there've been more executions in the United States this year than for a century So actually, if you go on, you know, Amnesty International website, or you know, you go and look at what the human rights lobbyists talk about in terms of countries around the world, you find that yes, Saudi Arabia has huge problems associated with it from a Western perspective, and also, of course, internally for those who are persecuted in the country. And at the moment, for example, there's a female activist in Saudi Arabia who's just gone on trial, you know, and her crime, it would appear, is that, you know, for example, she was promoting women driving before women were permitted to drive in Saudi Arabia, and she was particularly vocal in her protests against the Saudi Arabian regime's approach and the laws of the land concerning that. So, you know, this is a very complex and political topic. My personal view is that there is an opportunity afforded by sport to shine a spotlight on these issues, and actually to give a platform for those who want to protest against a regime or a way of doing things. For example, the LGBT community, you know, for me, this is an opportunity for them to really focus attention on what happens to members of their community in Saudi Arabia, the way in which you can be, you know, you can be prosecuted. There is, in theory, you could potentially be sentenced to death in Saudi Arabia. But as I point out in the column, there are other countries that we have happily raced in for many years, including Malaysia and Singapore, where equally you can be prosecuted if you're gay. And it's actually quite shocking when you go and read about the laws covering that. So, you know, my view is that if we retrench and say, well, we can only race in a country where, from a Western perspective, everything is just is crystal clear and where we feel completely comfortable, there wouldn't actually be that many countries in the world where we could race. So I think the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix is actually an opportunity. I'll also say that I know from talking to people in Saudi and talking to people in Formula One who already do business in Saudi, the change that is taking place in that country at the present time is absolutely astonishing. I mean, there is a really concerted effort to shift the way they conduct business internally, the way laws are applied. There are more freedoms. You know, cinemas, for example, are being introduced. Women are allowed to drive. A Western sport like Formula One, which, by the way, is sponsored by, you know, alcohol companies like a Heineken, for example, being welcomed into the country. Quite major changes. So when you talk to someone who lives in Riyadh, or you talk to someone who lives in Jeddah, they will happily say to you, actually, Mark, this is part of a much larger process of movement, and really it's great that Formula One is playing a part in that shift.
Do you think Formula One could make more effort to promote what you've just talked about when it decides to have races in places like Saudi Arabia? Because previously, the argument that always comes up whenever there's a human rights issue or a questionable political aspect to a race is that, Formula One is a sport. It exists outside of politics. It shouldn't be used. We have fans and our own readers who agree with this view that they shouldn't mix. But of course, Formula One has now overtly mixed the two in supporting Lewis Hamilton's campaign and declaring "We race as one" before every race and pledging to stamp out racism and inequality and improve diversity and opportunity for all, etc. So now Formula One is saying, well, we are a political platform, or at least we're supporting a political platform. So does it now have a responsibility to push for these changes in the places that it races and promote these places when they are making shifts towards that agenda, rather than just open themselves up constantly to attack by saying, you know, we're just a racing series, we're just a sport?
I it's a good question, because the reality is, I think Formula One and other sports need to be a little bit more grown up in the way they approach these things. Now, you can understand, I think the three of us can understand, that if you're Formula One and you go in to negotiate a deal with the Saudi government, with the promoter there, to have a Grand Prix, if they say to you, well, how are you going to handle the political fallout from this, you're certainly not going to muddy the waters of the negotiation by saying, well, we're going to say that we're going to campaign against everything that you stand for. So, you know, that's not going to be particularly helpful. However, what there could be... The art of the deal, exactly. But however, what you could do is you could be saying, look, these issues are going to come up. Let's agree a position. And here's what we think our position is. So our position is that we're going to be bringing a spotlight of the world on your country. And clearly for people in, you know, back home in our country, be it in the United Kingdom or in the USA, in the case of Liberty, you know, the media are going to say the following things. Look, you can write the script, can't you? You can actually write the headlines. It's not difficult. As I said in the column, you know, everyone loves a sport selling its soul to a regime that they say is corrupt or whatever. The reality is, you know, as well as much as anything, there needs to be a real understanding, therefore, and I'm sure the Saudis get it, and I've read what the Saudi authorities have been saying about Formula One, and they completely understand what the Western media view is going to be. They're ready for it. It's not new. They've been there before. Goodness knows they've had pretty big... scandals to deal with in recent years, including the murder of the journalist Khashoggi in Istanbul a couple of years back, which, you know, has been headline news around the world, you know, over the last 2 years. So the reality is that the Saudis know what the issues are, and I'm sure Liberty know what the issues are. I heard an interview actually with Chase Carey about the Saudi Grand Prix, and he felt underprepared for the interview. He felt underprepared for the questions. He had a kind of a stock answer around, we're motor racing. We're here to bring a global sport to Saudi. It's not for us to deal with all of the political questions. And I felt he was under unprepared, or if he wasn't unprepared, that actually he hadn't really been provided with a really coherent statement about the fact that actually, if you as a member of the media are asking me about why we're going to Saudi Arabia, why don't you come to Saudi Arabia and interview the people who are putting the race on and you know, meet them and talk to them face to face? I mean, I didn't include it in the column, but a few years ago I went to Tehran in Iran, and I'd been invited to speak at a conference, and I thought long and hard about, do I want to go to Iran? You know, I hear so many negative things about Iran, of course. Every day you hear negative things about Iran in the Western media. And being dual nationality, I used my Irish passport to get a visa, went to Tehran, spent a week there, had an amazing time, was incredibly well treated by all the people that I went to see, and was very struck, really struck when I arrived, by the fact that at the event that I spoke at, I had business people, men and women. Interestingly, 50% of the audience at that event were women. Men and women coming up to me and saying, you know, it's really great to have you here in Iran talking about Formula One. And, you know, but why does your country hate us so much? And, you know, we're all really terrified in Tehran at the moment because we think the Israelis are going to bomb our nuclear facilities and are going to bomb Tehran. We think the Americans and the British and the French are going to support that. And we're really frightened by the Western governments. And I said, you know, you do realise that there's no one wants to have a war with your country. And actually, you know, I was very happy to come here and find out for myself. And I at that conference, there were several pretty major Western business leaders with me in Tehran for that. And by the last night when we all had dinner together, we all said, it's really interesting how the news story that we get, the narrative that we get in the West about Iran is incredibly different from what you find on the ground when you talk to Iranian people in their capital city. And I feel the same must be true of Saudi Arabia and many of these other countries that we go to as well. I haven't had particularly bad negative experiences in any country that Formula One races in at the moment. And when you consider that this year in 2020, while we've all been tied up dealing with the COVID pandemic, you know, Azerbaijan, which is a country where we do have a race, has been having a shooting war with, you know, they've been in a proper war with Armenia next door. Mm-hmm. The political dimensions of all of this, what's actually happening around the world, means that, you know, we have to be grown up about our approach to dealing with this. And I think really the conclusion of my column, you know, and thanks for your comments, Ben, but the conclusion of my column is, you know, let's use the openness and transparency and freedom of speech of living in a Western democracy to talk about the topics rather than saying things like, I had a Formula One colleague on Twitter saying, you know, he said, I will not go to Saudi Arabia. I'm not going to use my press accreditation. I refuse to support refuse to support that regime. That's a
slippery slope to go down, isn't
that's
it?
That's a really yeah,
don't
slippery...
Don't go to China, really don't go to Azerbaijan.
Slope. That's a really slippery...
You might as well sit on the sofa and not go to any race. Yeah, I think you could make similar arguments about pretty much every race on the calendar from one perspective or the other.
Yeah. So anyway, there we go.
It's interesting that you mentioned Azerbaijan because that is a race I had misgivings about going there before I kind of had a word with myself and said, but you know, you've been to Bahrain, China, Malaysia, etc., other places.
Get down off your moral high horse.
Yes. Was it in Downton Abbey where the Dowager Duchess advised someone to carry a jumper because the air's a little thin and cold on the moral high ground? Azerbaijan in particular slightly gave me the creeps because at the time my wife worked for a company that rented ships out to the oil prospecting industry, and one of her colleagues had been to Azerbaijan, had been to Baku many times during the course of being in the oil business, and he related this sort of very alarming story of I think back in the 90s when the present regime was I think the father of the current president or something had shuffled off this mortal coil and a power struggle ensued and it all got a little bit bloody. And there was open revolt on the streets of Baku, and for the Azerbaijan Grand Prix, all the drivers stay in that very glittery, posh hotel that's kind of in the centre of the paddock. I forget its exact name, but it's a recent construction. Another hotel stood on that site in the past, and that's where my wife's colleague was staying. And he related this story where he was just going to go out and have a walk, get something to eat, and the concierge says, don't go out tonight, sir. Something's going to happen, and that was when they set the tanks on the citizenry, and this guy basically watched from his balcony as tanks rolled over people, and I kind of thought, do I really want to go to a country that does that sort of thing? But on the other hand, like you say,
you've been to a country that's done that.
I've been to Tiananmen Square.
You've been to Beijing. Yeah. You've been to China. Yeah.
So. You know, engaging with these countries and learning about them, you understand why they get to those places. And like you say, Azerbaijan is a country that geographically very interesting. It's got a great big sea on one side. It's got a practically impassable mountain range on the other. And the only one of the few means of escape is via a country that they literally don't get on with. And as you say, shots fired. So you can understand why countries that are geographically and politically encircled and feel embattled are quite spiky to deal with, and perhaps don't necessarily when you're on the outside looking in, you don't really see the full picture. Like you say with Iran, Iran is a country that carries a certain image around the world, which as you found maybe didn't necessarily tally with your experience.
I mean after all, we've been going to Russia, not, you know, perhaps not happily been going to Russia, but we've been going to Russia for years for Formula One, you know, and this is a country that has an unhealthy tourism interest in Salisbury Cathedral. And, you know, we'll happily
give
you...
It's a magnificent spire. It's very tall.
We'll happily give you half a pint of Novichok if you fancy it. But the reality is that every sport has to make decisions about where it goes. And the moment... I mean, I found it very interesting, for example, when we used to go to South Africa for the Grand Prix, and then the South African government made it very clear that they expected, I mean, they expected almost a civil war to erupt with the end of apartheid. And so Formula One stopped going to South Africa. And I think it's a shame. I think it's a glaring omission, for example, that Formula One doesn't have an event on the African continent. And every time I go to South Africa, people say to me, we wish Formula One came here. And people like, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa, big Formula One fan, actually quite a few Formula One fans amongst the ANC leadership. And again, in A1GP, we went there and had a race in Kyalami, and the reception we got was just amazing, absolutely astonishing. In fact, Ferrari sent Felipe Massa to that race to do a promotion with us, because I think we were running the Ferrari engine car by that stage. And, you know, again, huge reaction and a great response. So I think the more you travel, the more you realise that there is actually more that joins us together than separates us. And it's very dangerous to start to take that high ground that you talked about. And I think there's also another important point about Saudi Arabia, which is that, I mean, I'm not Muslim, I'm Christian. I was born into a Christian family. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, when I read people in talking about Saudi Arabia, there has to be a recognition that the Muslim faith has its home there, and the Sharia law that is applied is part of that tradition that is applied there. And actually, is it right for us to make judgment about an entire religion? We may not like some of the things that they do any more than a lot of people don't like what, for example, the Roman Catholic tradition has, and, you know, as born into that tradition in my family in Ireland. I've spent the last 40 years witnessing what's been wrong with the Roman Catholic religion in relation to, for example, women's rights and abortion and homosexuality. And goodness knows, it's been a religion that has been plagued by a child sex abuse scandal. So actually, every religion has got challenges associated with it. And I think, again, that's another reason we all have to really zoom out, stand back and say, let's be careful about being the first person to throw a stone, because we've all got our own demons to deal with closer to home.
Well, I'm indeed a godless heathen, so I don't think I'd be popular with any regime, to be honest with you.
But I do
take your point, particularly about sport as a unifying force, Mark. And I think the mention of South Africa is quite interesting because, of course, you know, post-apartheid, Nelson Mandela was very keen on the Rugby World Cup being hosted in that country and using it as a vehicle to unify his people. Mm-hmm. Because even though you had this terrible racial divide that existed for many years before, the whole country loved rugby, and he could see the power of having that international tournament, not only unifying people within the country, but then showing the rest of the world how the country had moved on. So it's all, as ever, these situations are never as clear cut or as obvious as people like to make out on social media accounts.
I mean, it can be a powerful unifying force, can't it, sport? It can be a means of extracting money from dodgy regimes, but it can also, as you say, be a means of uniting people.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting as well. I often think about Liberty's desire to increase the number of races. We've got 23 races, as you were saying, in 2021, and we know that they would like to take that even higher, up towards 25 races. And I sometimes think, I hope that in this decade that we're now into, that we see some adjustments in the business model around Formula One. And maybe the COVID pandemic this year has opened the eyes of Liberty to other ways to create races and to make them happen. Because we've seen a very positive reaction to having an event in Portugal, with the possibility that there might now be a movement towards having a Portuguese Grand Prix in the future. We've seen some of the other venues that we've visited this year, Imola and Mugello, proving to be very popular with the fans to see the sport race there. But when I look at South Africa, for example, I think, well, what we do know is that if the South African government decided to spend $50 million a year having a Formula One race, that would go down like a lead balloon with taxpayers in South Africa, where there is, there's huge poverty, the huge division. However, I then look at the big sponsors in Formula One, and I look at the big companies in South Africa. But South Africa is still a very successful market for many very large companies. And I think, well, actually, if you put together a different kind of business model where you created a portfolio of major companies who would fund a sporting event of the kind of Formula One to bring it to the country, that actually is a different proposition. So instead of spending taxpayers' money, you create a privately funded event, and that could actually create employment in South Africa, and certainly could help again to adjust the perception internally and externally of South Africa. And so I do think that there is an opportunity for Formula One to go to places where there is actually an inherent interest in having the sport there, and maybe to be a little bit more creative with the business model in order to make events happen.
Do you think that maybe there's an argument that because Formula One has obviously taken on huge debts, you know, it was a leveraged purchase or that sort of thing, and it requires large sums of money to be input, there is this tendency to chase after the huge deals, when actually if you had lots and lots of smaller deals, then you would probably overall encourage a little bit more buy-in? Because that was something I was very aware of back in the day when GP racing was part of the Haymarket empire, that there was some sort of, shall I say, dinosaur mentality, senior commercial people who were only interested in the huge ticket items that would bring in megabucks, whereas lots and lots of smaller deals actually just lubricates the wheels a lot better commercially.
Well, you've just summarized, for example, the success that Zak Brown has had at McLaren over the last 5 years in turning the commercial operation of McLaren around. Now, under Ron Dennis's leadership, McLaren was all about the big ticket sponsor. They were looking for a title sponsor to replace Vodafone having replaced West, a tobacco company, who themselves replaced Marlboro, another tobacco company. Those big deals are gone. You know, there aren't companies out there with $70, $80 million to spend on a title sponsorship of a Formula One team. So you look at the McLaren today and you see those much smaller strategic deals with amazing brands like, you know, Coca-Cola. You know, people have chased Coca-Cola to get them into Formula One for years. Zak Brown has gotten Coca-Cola into Formula One. It is a much more strategic deal. It's a smaller deal. The car is not painted red and white. You know, it doesn't have Coca-Cola splashed all over it. But the point is that Zak understands that, and actually, it's better for a Formula One team to have a large number of smaller commercial partners, because I remember, as Patrick Head once said to me way back in the late 1980s, I remember Patrick Head saying to me, you know, one of the best things for Williams at that time was they had so many sponsors. He said, it actually doesn't matter if one of them doesn't renew, because we've got all the other ones and we make sure we stagger the deals so that they don't all come up for renewal at the same time. And I mean, talking to investors in Formula One, you talk about the leveraged deal that Formula One, that Liberty did to take over Formula One. The investment in community in Formula One are very interested to know where the growth is going to come from. And the growth can come from having more events. But with 23 events already, we're getting towards the ceiling. You know, we've got 23, maybe we could have 25. There are much bigger opportunities, I think, to grow the sponsorship base in Formula One. And at the moment, Formula One is a world championship, doesn't actually have that many sponsors. You know, we've got Heineken, we have Aramco, we have Rolex, we have DHL. But actually, where's Visa and MasterCard? Where's McDonald's? Where's Pepsi Cola? Where are the other big deals of the kind that you see in the FIFA World Cup and the Olympic Games, where you have, you know, 16 or 20 major sponsors of the global series? Now, Liberty haven't cracked that nut yet, and I suspect that some of the approach that's been taken in the past to Formula One, trying to focus on the big deals, I think life has changed, and I do think that a larger number of smaller deals might be a much more beneficial way forward for the sport. And so I would concur, Stuart, very much. The fact is that, you know, the world has changed and everyone has to cut their cloth accordingly. And I think there is an opportunity for Formula One at the moment, because post-COVID, yes, there will be less money in the system in 2021, 2022, probably 2023 as well. But actually, fortuitously, we've also got a budget cap in Formula One for the first time. And there might be a glide path where that cap's going to come down further. So actually, it feels like the sports in it maybe for the first time is approaching a point where it's quite sustainable as a business, and it just needs to keep moving in that direction. So let's hope that people like Ben Pincus, who is the relatively recently appointed head of sponsorships for Formula One, you know, takes an alternative view of how to attract the partners that can, you know, strengthen the sport and you know, increase the revenue and the profitability for everyone.
Just need to lower that rate card and then sort the engines out.
Yeah, and you see that, and you know, the trouble
one
is,
thing at a time.
Yeah, the thing is, it's really interesting. You know, Ron Dennis and Ekram Sami, who was the previous commercial boss at McLaren, used to sort of rage against the notion of reducing the rate card. You know, we don't want to reduce the rate card any further. Of course, it's not about making it more, it's not about making it cheaper. It's about making it more accessible. Because as you bring the price of entry down, you actually adjust the benefits that you provide for that. So you're not giving away the shop for a smaller price. You're actually saying, we're just going to tailor packages in a much more focused way. And if a multi-billion dollar brand like Coca-Cola says, actually, we don't want the naming rights of your team. We don't want the car to look like a Coca-Cola can. What we actually want to do is to have some quite discreet promotions in different key markets around the world. We want to use it for PR. We want to use it for a little bit of corporate hospitality.
Why listen not to them and adapt.
Listen to them and adapt. You know, tailor your package accordingly. It's. I had a chat with Christian Horner about this in Russia at the Grand Prix a few years ago, because he asked me, he said, how the hell did Jordan have so many sponsors? And I said, well, because we were hungry and we fought tooth and nail for every deal, whether it was 100 grand or 1 million or 2 million or 5 million. And as a result, we ended up with all these, you know, what Eddie used to refer to as bits and pieces. I remember sitting with Ian Phillips in a meeting one day, and Eddie was saying to us, you know, well, we got Benson and Hedges and we have DHL and then we got all these other bits and pieces. Well, we added up the bits and pieces. It was $37 million. I mean, that's, you know, it's quite hard to lose that down the back of the sofa. You know, $37 million of bits and pieces. And to my mind, I think that's a little bit what has been lost. And I'm not saying that finding sponsorship is easy. But when I look at teams that are effectively unsponsored, like Williams, like Haas, I really do wonder, is there something flawed in their overall approach to getting these deals together? Because, you know, Zak Brown has shown what's possible. He came into a McLaren team that for a period there looked quite unsponsored and has successfully rebuilt an impressive commercial portfolio.
Yeah, it feels like the quest for big ticket sponsors has led to when those big ticket sponsors don't turn up, you get the big ticket drivers or drivers who have rich dads. But let's not go down that rabbit hole, because the clock in the corner of my screen suggests that we're about to turn into a glass slipper. So we're going to have to wrap up for our
I'm
final
really, really disappointed. I'm really disappointed we can't talk about social media inadequacies of certain Russian racing drivers, but we'll have to leave that for another time.
Yes, well, that was doubly... It was irritating for us because we were in the process of sending a magazine that had a two-page feature about Nikita Mazepin. So it obviously put us in a quandary where we actually had to sit and watch that video and kind of work out whether a crime had been committed or whether it was just, you know, a grubby little scroat being a grubby little scroat, in which case it probably on the balance isn't worth actually halting the printing of a magazine to remove someone and put him in something else, unless, as we say, a crime had been committed. So,
but if you want to read about F1's newest lout, as Ted Kravitz called him during the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, there are two pages on him,
yes,
on the back of a wider story about the Haas team, which is why we printed this story, actually.
Exactly.
How that team's rebooting for next year and out with the old and in with the new and in with the new bags of cash, most likely, as well.
Yeah, you know, it's rigorous, and it was worth introducing this person whose dad is now going to be underwriting the racing effort of Haas in the coming season. Whether he appears in GP racing again, who knows? He'll actually have to clean up his act and do something worth reporting on. So, yes, enjoy these two pages while you can. And that'll be it from him, as it's it from us for this year. And one of the things that struck me over the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix weekend was that that race happened 9 months to the day since... 9 months a day after the Australian Grand Prix was officially postponed, and at the end of that day our CEO told us to go home and not come back to the office the following Monday. And so 9 months of huge uncertainty. Obviously our sister magazine Autosport went on pause. There was no guarantee it would come back, no guarantee we'd be able to carry on through the pandemic, given that shops were shut. But thanks to everyone who listens, thanks to everyone who reads the magazine, we've carried on, and we're still here, and we will carry on serving you up your monthly dose of Formula One fever through 2021. And hopefully things will look up in 2021, and we'll be back in January, faster than you can say catastrophic no-deal Brexit. So I'll say thank you to my guests. Thank you, Mark Gallagher.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Happy Christmas and Happy New Year to everyone.
And happy landings in Australia. We'll be speaking to you from your hotel room. Hopefully you've got robust Wi-Fi there.
Yeah, fingers crossed that Aussie Wi-Fi is up to the job.
And thank you very much, Ben Anderson, speaking to us from the newly becalmed Anderson household.
Yes, thank you, Codders. Yeah, an enjoyable hour spent with the peace of the creche quietened for once. Yeah.
And it seems that despite the sunshine here around Codling Manor, the tree surgeons have elected to not continue their work. So hopefully the cats will sleep in peace this afternoon. So, yeah, that's it. We'll be back with another Flat Chat next year. And we will be celebrating the February 2021 issue of GP Racing. Thanks to Grant and Martin, our producers. I've been Stuart Codling. We'll see you in a month's time.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.